In this 15-minute talk, Robbie Nelson explains what socialists mean by the term working class and why it's central to both our analysis of capitalism and to our vision of post-capitalist society. Robbie presented this talk at a regional political education training event in June conducted by DSA's National Political Education Committee. The event, for which Robbie was also one of the lead organizers, included members from several chapters in New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Maine. Robbie Nelson is a member of New York City DSA and a rank-and-file public school teacher. He has been organizing in the Democratic Socialists of America for more than 3 years and in the broader movement for almost a decade, largely focused on labor and political education. He is also a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus within DSA.
Why the working class? So the question that we're going to be addressing today is, why the working class? Now, this title is taken from a classic article by the mid-20th century U.S. socialist named Hal Draper. And it's also reflected in the title of a more recent piece by Vivek Chibber in Jacobin, which is relatively short and a very useful piece that covers some of the same subject matter. So this proposition, why the working class, is, at its heart, a great distillation of socialist strategy for achieving the society we want. As Draper writes to open his piece, why do socialists believe there is a special connection between our own great goal of a new society and the interests of labor, this one segment of society? Is it because we idealize workers as being better, or more clever, or more honest, or more courageous, or more humanitarian than non-workers? Draper's answers to those questions is an emphatic no, and today we're going to be taking some time to dig into this relationship between the working class and the fight for a better world and a socialist future. But before we can even take up that question in earnest, we have to take a step back and ask a few fundamental questions. Firstly, what is the working class? Which raises the further question of what is a class? And which raises the further question of what is capitalism? Now, obviously, the question what is capitalism is a massively complex one, the answer to which can fill many books, you know, Capital Volumes 1, 2, and 3. But I'll give my 3-minute best here to talk about the basics and fundamentals of what capitalism is. So, by my account, capitalism is an economic and social system that, at its core, relies on the exploitation of labor in order to produce profit, which is reinvested by capitalists in order to seek greater and greater profit. Now, this system relies on a certain set of class relations. First is the capitalist class, which you'll see many times referred to as the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, the owning class, or simply the bosses. They are the ones who control the flow of investment and hold private ownerships in the farms, factories, and businesses that produce and distribute stuff. Right? So capitalists own stuff, and they exploit labor by paying their workers wages that are less than the value of the stuff they produce. I know this is sort of basic, but I actually find it very valuable to linger on these sort of basic micro foundations. So, if it takes me or you, a McDonald's employee, 1 hour to make 20 hamburgers, and those burgers are sold for a total of $40, then you produced $40 worth of value in that 1 hour. But if you live in a state lucky enough to have a $15 minimum wage, you only get paid $15 for that hour. So you produced $40 worth of value, but you only get paid $15 for your hour of labor. So that remaining $25, the difference between the $40 and the $15, is what Marxists call surplus value. And that's where profit comes from. Now this is really important, since this micro interaction between every worker and every boss gives us the key to understanding why, under capitalism, class conflict is inevitable, right? Class conflict isn't just when workers fight back or when bosses do something especially egregious. It's inherent in every micro interaction in the system between every worker and every boss. And that's because every dollar of higher wages for workers is a dollar of lower profit for capitalists. And capital can only pay workers so much before the profitability of their firm collapses, you know, and the whole thing goes kaput. So just to underscore, class describes a relationship to the means of production. Capitalists own the farms, factories, banks, and business firms. In other words, capitalists own the land, the buildings, the machines, and the financing necessary to produce stuff. Workers, on the other hand, do not own the means of production, and we instead get paid a wage or salary by the owners of those means of production in exchange for our labor. Members of the working class either can get paid that wage themselves, or we rely on a family member who gets paid a wage. Okay, so this situation sounds pretty shitty, right? I mean, why would anyone want to be an exploited worker in this scenario? Well, the fact is that, you know, we don't have any other means of subsistence, of living. In past societies, including feudal societies, most people who worked were still able to access their means of subsistence via hunting, small cultivation on your own farm plot, etc. You know, this isn't a great system for a lot of reasons. I wouldn't really want to live under it, but most people still had some kind of access to a means of subsistence outside of the market. The enclosure of the common lands in which people were able to gain their means of subsistence in late medieval, early modern England was only the first in a long chain of dispossession, or as Marx called it, the primitive accumulation of capital. In other words, huge populations needed to be violently separated from their traditional means of making their livelihoods, mostly off the land, in order to force them into wage labor. So, wage labor under capitalism produces this sort of sick and ersatz freedom. We might be able to choose to work, right, but for company X rather than company Y, but we are not free to choose whether to work for wages or not. For those who don't own the farms, the factories, and the businesses, the choice is not really a choice at all. Work for someone else's business or starve. In Marx's view, workers, the working class, we own nothing but our own labor, and we are forced to sell that labor on the market to the exploiters in order to get the stuff we need, food, shelter, etc., to reproduce our livelihoods. Okay, so we've just gone on a whirlwind tour of some of the basic dynamics of capitalism, you know, what some of the, you know, the major classes are, and the nature, or at least the micro foundations, of the inevitable conflict between the working class and the capitalist class. So now we are equipped to take on the initial proposition that we began with: why the working class? So in his piece, Vivek Chhibber strips this back to basics, which I find very illuminating. Chhibber claims that people of good conscience, we see a world of hierarchy, of material insecurity, of social domination, of interpersonal violence, and we seek to change it. But if we want to make any kind of change in society, moving in the direction of greater freedom and equality for all, then we will immediately run up against an obstacle. And that obstacle is the resistance of the ruling class. After all, they do not want society to change. Why would they? They are the ones who are benefiting mostly from it. And moreover, they have the power to stop it from changing in a lot of senses, right? They control most of what goes on society. They have at their fingertips access to resources, financial, physical, political, ideological, that they will mobilize in a fight, in a hard fight against us who want to, you know, change the social, you know, the society that we live in. So now we've moved into the realm of strategy, right? And strategy at its broadest level, right, in the socialist sense, is how can the forces of freedom and equality find a way to outmatch the hugely powerful enemies and obstacles that we are up against? In other words, as Chhibber says, where is our leverage? And now we really get to the heart of the question. Because capitalists exploit workers, and so they have an antagonistic relationship to workers. But of course, that also means that they rely on workers. I mean, that's what Marx's idea of dialectics is, right? There's an antagonistic relationship between capital and labor, but there's also a reliance. In, you know, to put this concretely, if we aren't working, That means surplus value isn't getting created, right? That means a capitalist can't skim off our labor time. And that means that the flow of profit is getting disrupted. Now, this is at the heart of why workers go on strike. And this is why strikes are effective. Because workers, we say, hey, if we don't get what we want, then we're going to stop production and thus stop the flow of profits until we achieve our demands. Now, this is the key to understanding political struggle through a materialist lens. The bosses are not just going to give us what they want out of the goodness of their hearts. They're only going to make concessions if the threat of our action has the potential to cost them as much or more than the price of our demands. Since there is an inevitable conflict between capital and labor, any demand that we make is going to come out of their pocket. So we need to change the balance of forces so that it seems reasonable and rational for the bosses, or the ruling class at large, to concede to our demands. Of course, this is way easier said than done. The hard part of a strike or of any political action is the organizing. We can't just wish things into being. And for most workers, it's very rational just to keep our heads down, do our jobs, and try not to rock the boat too much. We're worried about getting fired or of being harmed. And the job of organizers is to lower those barriers to entry into collective action and show people that through shared struggle and action, there's safety and power in numbers, right? They can't fire us all. And this holds not just at the level of an individual workplace, but at the level of society at large. Eric Blanc says in one of his great Jacobin pieces about the teacher strikes, quote, "Workplace action and strikes remain our most powerful weapon. There's no equivalent form of action that creates as deep a crisis for capital and the state." So the forces of freedom and equality, that's us, we need to create a crisis within the ruling class in order to win our demands. And because of the fact that, under capitalism, the ruling class depends on workers doing our jobs to create profit and keep society running, workers are strategically positioned to create such a crisis. So, to sum up this question, workers have the potential capacity, if we get organized, to withdraw our labor and hit the system right where it hurts, in the profit margin. It's only by hitting the ruling class's pocketbook directly and indirectly that we can have the leverage to win the huge demands that we want to win. So I'm going to switch tacks a little bit and try to tie this overall conceptual perspective to our present moment. And this is something a lot of people have been asking. What does the working class or workplace organizing have to do with our current moment, both in terms of the pandemic and more in some ways more obviously, in the midst of the huge protest wave against police brutality and police murder of black people, racism, and state repression more generally. So aside from obviously, you know, being out in the street if you're able to, donating to bail funds, and basically doing anything we can to stand in solidarity with these black-led uprisings and protest waves, socialists can also play a key role in helping to bring the structural power of the whole working class to bear on this struggle. First and foremost, right, like black worker self-organizing and multiracial working class solidarity has been at the heart of every major progressive political shift in U.S. history, from the Civil War and emancipation to the upsurges of the 1930s and the 1960s. So I'm going to briefly discuss a few small but important examples from the current uprising. And before I give them, it's worth saying that, these are relatively small and inadequate to winning the demands we want. And the response of the actual leadership of organized labor unions in this country has been, though in some places good, broadly kind of lackluster. But to show some positive examples in cities across the country to sort of demonstrate the power of the working class in winning demands for racial justice and for all kinds of justice. So, in multiple cities, from Minneapolis to San Francisco to New York City, unionized city bus drivers, who in all of these cities are predominantly black and Latino, have refused to transport police to protests or have refused to transport arrested protesters to jail for booking. And the withdrawal of their labor had a significant material impact on the field of play in these protests, right? It makes it harder and more costly for police to do the repressive job that they want to do when other city workers refuse to cooperate with them. We've also seen port and longshore workers in several different unions go on short, either hour-long or day-long strikes in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. While these short actions are largely symbolic, they also carry with them the threat of greater escalation, greater disruption, and greater leverage. And the port workers, particularly the ILWU workers on the West Coast ports, have a long history of labor radicalism and of international solidarity. So many of these were communist-led unions, and the ILWU in particular stood in solidarity with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa in the 1980s, and with the Palestine solidarity movement, throughout the 90s, 2000s, and ongoing today. So again, these symbolic strikes can be powerful insofar as they show the willingness of labor to withdraw our labor and to disrupt the system in solidarity with broader social movements, and that is really key. On a sort of smaller scale and more scattered scale, we've also seen several instances of restaurant workers walking off the job against their bosses who were making them give free sandwiches to cops and things like that. Again, these are relatively small, but they contain within them the seeds of solidarity that really have the power to move mountains. We've seen teachers, either through our unions or through caucuses within our unions or just informal coalitions, push to use our leverage to demand police-free schools and disrupting the school-to-prison pipeline. So these offer a broad, sketched outline of a roadmap to winning demands and building power. And we can also apply these principles to the other crises that our society faces, the coronavirus pandemic or the looming threat of climate change. There have been so much organizing, particularly aided by socialists, some within DSA itself, through the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, EWOC, and other committees around DSA have helped essential workers get hazard pay, protective equipment, and end harassment and union busting by their bosses in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. So labor should not be understood as some sort of special interest group, but rather the leverage through which the working class can win demands on all sorts of issues. If we want to win an equitable resolution to all of the crises that our society faces, then our political project needs to be anchored in workers organizing to take action at the point of production, causing broad disruption that the ruling class just can't ignore. While we shouldn't downplay the role of street protests, workers in their workplaces, both those in unions and not in unions, we have the structural leverage to actually win key demands for racial justice, against police repression, and for 100 other demands that we need to make society to win a society of freedom, equality, and abundance for all. If we want that society, then we need to connect the power of movements in the streets to the power of elected officials in the state to the power of workers in our workplaces. And that is the hope of the socialist movement, and that is something that I am optimistic that DSA can play a really positive role in. Thank you.